George Washington and the American victory in the Revolutionary War, or the War for Independence. That's our topic on this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now we return as a guest, Dr. Peter Lilback. He and I had the privilege to write a book together called George Washington's Sacred Fire. ProvidenceForum.org for more information. The book, by the way, was published by Providence Forum. Dr. Lilback, thanks so much for joining us again.
Jerry, it's such an honor to be part of your broadcast ministry. Thank you.
Sure. And I understand that George Washington said in his first inaugural address that nobody, I mean, I'm going to paraphrase him here, but no people should be more grateful than the people of the United States to Almighty God for his help in helping us to become a nation. And that, of course, would include the terrible situation of the war for independence, where this ragtag team of, you know, of colonists consisting of farmers and merchants and so forth were literally facing the strongest navy in the world, the strongest army, I believe, in the world, and yet somehow we prevailed. Tell us about that.
It truly is an amazing story that a ragtag army, this motley crew of American patriots, were able to take on the British and win the war. From the beginning, there were a few who had a vision to have this war, and they believed that the Americans could win. And probably the most important ones were the ones from the Boston area, which would be Sam Adams, John Hancock, Paul Revere, those group of folks. They had the fighting spirit that came from their struggle with the British from the Congregational tradition. You remember they were part of the Puritans in that famous Civil War that chopped off the head of Charles I when Oliver Cromwell took over. They were part of that tradition. So they already had this sense of we don't want to be part of the British tyranny where the crown is forcing their will on us. They had that fiery spirit. But they also had this high view of God's providence. They believed in this Calvinistic idea that God is the Lord of history, that God would stand on the side of justice, and that they already questioned the idea of the divine right of the king. They said a king that's disobeying God doesn't have a right to rule. Now, that was not true of other traditions. The Anglican tradition really believed that, you know, the king is there by God's blessing, and you just have to accept whatever the king brings. So that's a big debate that's in the background. So there was already a theological reason that many of the colonies would not want to resist, and that made it questionable. But these people that had this view that American independence was legitimate in the face of tyranny, they had several things going for them. One, they believed that it was just. A just God in heaven would side with that which is right. Secondly, pragmatically, they looked at the vast ocean, 3,000 miles of ocean, even with a very powerful king and navy, it was going to be a very, very difficult task to keep bringing armaments and an army all the way over to this new world to fight a battle. Thirdly, they had already fought. The Americans, while they were not an army, had already been hardened by the French and Indian War, and there was heroism and strength, and the Americans had fought for their own rights. So they had some experience, not enough to be sure, but they had a guy like Washington who actually had some military experience. They already had a navy because they had to deal with the fact that there were no roads in the colonies, and so the rivers and the oceans were the best means of conveyance. So they had some of the things. And then finally, they had the advantage, if you will, of the wilderness. The British really realized they would have to fight their battles in cities, but the Americans always could retreat out of the way of the easily accessible areas for a traditional European army. They could go off into the mountains, into the woods, and they would not easily be found. So those were the kind of things they gambled on. All of those were behind them. But the thing that really made it possible were two things. One was the wiliness of Washington as a warrior, the surprise attack that he was able to do from time to time, like the crossing of the Delaware and the Battle of Trenton, and then the surprise that followed at Princeton that kept them alive. Secondly, the victory at Saratoga, where General Greene was able to bottle them up in this narrow ravine and really have a great victory because they used their territory to their advantage. But they also recognized that somehow Washington was able to keep his men going. And as long as there was not a checkmate blow, there was the fatigue factor. We just can't beat these people. We keep fighting. It keeps being expensive. We can't win. And finally, they felt like they would just wear them down. Of course, that's been often the way great empires have lost battles, like the Russians in Afghanistan, America in Vietnam. And you finally get tired. It's so costly, and you're not winning. You wonder, what are you going to do? Well, that was the strategy that Washington used. I'll always be out far enough. They cannot destroy me, and yet they can't win. And that means they're finally, after 7 or 8 years, they said, we quit. It's too expensive. Hmm. We're not winning. The people are tired. That was the strategy, and it worked.
And I've heard the term Fabian applied to that, George Washington fought a Fabian campaign, something to that effect.
Well, I'm not going to be able to put that into its historical context, not being enough of a military historian, but I would just simply say that was the idea of never quitting and never giving your enemy a death blow and forcing them to just run out of energy, because they had to keep bringing armaments in from 3,000 miles.
Hmm. Early,
they had to keep supporting it.
Sure, and early on, Benedict Arnold was of value to George Washington and the American cause, and then, of course, he turned traitor.
Yeah, today, the name for traitor is Benedict Arnold in the American language, and yet he was a war hero. He, in the early invasion of Canada to try to neutralize the potential of an attack from the north before the revolution officially started, he was wounded. He was considered a highly honored person. But Benedict Arnold, unfortunately, got into some financial problems. He had actually married a British loyalist's daughter, which gave him another reason to be able to speak with the other side. And then finally, when they offered him enough in his financial difficulty, he was willing to turn over not only West Point, but also the timing was such that they had expected Washington to actually be present there. So it would have been, they would have captured the commander-in-chief as well as West Point. And the remarkable uncovering of the secret plans by some sentries in the middle of the night through someone who was going through, they were able to get a heads up. But the word was such that they could not take West Point, but didn't get there quick enough to organize without Benedict Arnold being able to escape, who ended up going to England and was hoping that he could be able to become a very rich man. He was promised all kinds of land in Canada, which he never got to have because he died before he could ever develop it. So he dies a miserable, poor man, known as a traitor, but at least safe in England. But, you know, even in England, he was never really honored all that much because they realized he'd actually betrayed his own country. So what kind of a guy do you want to be related with? So that's part of the story. So there was a providential element that actually kept that plot from actually being, if you will, maybe a decisive defeat at West Point and also Washington. But we see the same kind of divine providence actually happening at the final great battle of Yorktown.
Oh, wait. Do you mind if I? Okay, we'll get to Yorktown in just a moment.
You're in charge, Jerry.
Oh, absolutely. But I understand that George Washington wrote a beautiful letter to Thomas Nelson Jr. after the discovery of the plot involving Benedict Arnold trying to, you know, hand over the West Point to the British. It was discovered, and George Washington, you know, what did he say? Because this is really a remarkable statement about George Washington and his Christian faith.
Well, there's my favorite one, writing to Thomas Nelson. He said, that man is a sinful indeed who cannot see the providence of God in this. He's worse than an unbeliever, worse than an infidel. In other words, Washington saw the fact of New York, where the British had been reduced, I think he says, to pick axe and shovel, unable to actually use all of their power. They're just fighting to keep themselves from being defeated by some kind of counterattack. He said, this is God's providence at work. If you can't see it, you're worse than an infidel. He's quoting the King James Bible when he says that. Mm. But then he says at the end, but I will add no more on the doctrine of providence. I will turn to preacher later. So basically he was saying, I'm starting to preach about providence. I'm going to stop. So then the question is, well, did he ever return to become a preacher of providence? Well, it's right where you started. It's when Washington now is the newly inaugurated president of the United States. His first inaugural address is nothing less than a sermon on providence. Mm-hmm. The first half of that wonderful message of the first president of the Constitution says, as you've already pointed out, there's no nation that has more to give thanks to God, reasons to give thanks to God than the United States. The signal interpositions of divine providence were seen everywhere in the story, that this small little group of people, small, humble army, these colonists trying to organize, were able to take on the British army and win. Washington saw that as providence. He saw God's work in it.
Yorktown.
Okay, Yorktown is an amazing story. Obviously, the French had had an opportunity to connect with America. Actually, the first meeting, as far as we can tell, of French representatives and representatives of the Continental Congress occurred here in Philadelphia in the second floor of Carpenter's Hall. This is where the first meeting actually happened in 1774 of the leaders of the American cause. But it was in the second floor where Benjamin Franklin had his loaning library. And one evening, someone came from France and other Americans. I think John Jay was there, and there was another American congressional leader. And the question came up, will the French stand with us if we decide to go for independence? And I like to say that's where the CIA was born, right on the second floor of Carpenter's Hall.
Huh.
So basically what we see there is that the French were absolutely strategic. Lafayette came. There were resources that finally came after Valley Forge. The word had come in from France. They were going to supply armaments, soldiers, the Navy. But the Navy never seemed to show up. That was one of the big problems. Washington always wanted the French Navy to come because that was the strong suit of the British. But it just so happened when Washington was dealing with Cornwallis outside of Yorktown, he realized that militarily, he had put his British army in a very precarious position on a peninsula. So in other words, they could be closed off without a land retreat by the American army. But Cornwallis was not afraid. He knew that if there was ever any problem, the British Navy would just move him off and he didn't have to fear. So there was a complacency. It just so happened that Washington got intelligence that the French had been able to cross the Atlantic and finally were just within striking distance of some place in North America. And so Washington concocted an extraordinary plan. He gave all the evidence that they were getting ready for an invasion of New York City. But on the other hand, that front force that looked like they were mounting, he sent everyone as much as he could south to Virginia. There was this speedy march of his soldiers all the way down the East Coast to get to Yorktown. And the siege was laid, and they began to bombard and attack Cornwallis. And when they got ready to try to leave, all of a sudden, the French Navy came in and cut off their escape. Mm. The timing was absolutely stunning. And further to complicate the matter, the British Navy in the North that would have come down to fight had experienced a tremendous tempest at sea that had damaged a number of their major fighting ships that had to go back and be repaired. So the French were able to bottleneck the escape. The British Navy had been damaged by sea and were late in arriving, and by the time they could muster their forces, the cannonades, the assaults, the siege on Yorktown was so great that there was no way to escape, and General Cornwallis had to surrender, and that meant the end of the war. This was the fighting force of the king in North America, and they could not escape.
Wow.
Lafayette was one of the heroes of that battle. So it's kind of interesting. Lafayette was leading soldiers in. Alexander Hamilton was leading soldiers in. Mm-hmm. The Navy was on the side keeping the escape from happening. And Washington, at the end of the victory, not prompted by anyone except by his own joy, called for a worship service. Mm-hmm. And in that call, he said, "This has been an extraordinary expression of divine providence, and we must worship and give thanks to God who's given us this great victory."
More details.
This was the end of the war.
Yes.
It didn't end for another year. They had to work out a lot of details. But this was the end of the fighting, and Cornwallis was forced to surrender. And, of course, the song they played as they marched to turn in their weapons was "The World Is Turned Upside Down." Indeed, that's what had happened. The young, new nation had successfully defeated this extraordinary army and navy. Could not have done it without the French, but could not have done it without the marvelous concatenation of Providence bringing all the pieces together at just the right moment. We call that Providence.
Dr. Peter Loback, again, thanks for joining us. ProvidenceForum.org for more information.